I think that just as we're living in a nuclear age, we have grown so tremendously in scientific knowledge, it doesn't seem too much to say that men can begin to awaken to the fact that they haven't grown enough spiritually and haven't recognized their spiritual capacities.
Once something like eating is death, then you've struck at the very heart of life. The enemy of the older radical theories may have been the ruling class, but today the stakes of whether we will reform ourselves into a new kind of human being, a new kind of society, whether we will find selves worth being, the stakes of it are simply life itself.
Hi, for the next few weeks, I'll be doing something a little different. I'm going to be reading from Platonic Dialogues, those places that I will be using in my summer seminar on Plato and early Christianity. So I'm going to read the selections and then I'll talk a little bit about them because I'd like to share some of this with you, whether you take the seminar or not. There's information about the seminar below. And let me just jump right in. All right. So hopefully this will work. The first passage I want to deal with is from Plato's Republic, Book 2. And it's at this spot where Adeimantus is kind of upping the ante after Glaucon challenges Socrates to really justify why you would be good and act justly, even if you've got no reward for it. And so Adeimantus just wants to kind of like pile on with that sentiment. And so I'm just going to read quite a bit of this so that you get an idea of this, and maybe you can identify a bit, because Adeimantus is basically talking about how society really thinks as opposed to what he and his brother are taught. All right, so I will start down at the bottom here. This is Grube's translation, which I really like. Okay, Adeimantus says, when fathers speak to their sons, they say one must be just, and so do all who care for them. But they don't praise justice itself, only the high reputations it leads to, in order that the son, thought to be just, shall enjoy those public offices, marriages, and the rest, which Glaucon mentioned, as they belong to the just man because of his high repute or reputation. They lay even greater emphasis on the results of reputation. They add popularity granted by the gods and mention abundant blessings, which, they say, the gods grant to the pious. So, too, the noble Hesiod and Homer declare, the one that for the just, the gods make, quote, the oak trees bear acorns at the top and bees in the middle and their fleecy sheep are heavy with their burdens of wool, end quote, and many other blessings of like nature. The others say similar things, like the fame of a goodly king who in his piety upholds justice. For him, the black earth bears wheat and barley and the trees are heavy with fruit, his sheep bear lambs continually, and the sea provides its fish. Musaeus and his son, grant from the gods more robust pleasures to the just. Their words lead the just to the underworld, and seating them at table, provide them with a banquet of the saints, crown them with wreaths, and make them spend all their time drinking, as if they thought that the finest rewards of virtue was perpetual drunkenness. Others stretch the rewards of virtue from the gods even further, for they say that the children and the children's children and the posterity of the pious man who keeps his oaths will survive into the future. Thus, and in other such ways, do they praise justice. The impious and unjust they bury in the mud in the underworld. They force them to carry water in a sieve. They bring them into disrepute while still living, and they attribute to them all the punishments which Glaucon enumerated in the case of the just, with a reputation for injustice. But they have nothing else to say. This, then, is the way people praise and blame justice and injustice. Besides this, Socrates, look at another kind of argument, which is spoken in private, and also by the poets concerning justice and injustice, All go on repeating with one voice that justice and moderation are beautiful, but certainly difficult and burdensome, while incontinence and injustice are sweet and easy and shameful only by repute and by law. They add that unjust deeds are for the most part more profitable than the just ones. They freely declare, both in private and in public, that the wicked who have wealth and other forms of power are happy. They honor them, but pay neither honor nor attention to the weak and the poor, though they agree that these are better men than the others. What men say about the gods and virtue is the most amazing of all, namely that the gods too inflict misfortunes and a miserable life upon many good men, and the opposite fate upon their opposites. Begging priests and prophets frequent the doors of the rich and persuade them that they possess a God-given power to remedy by sacrifices and incantations at pleasant festivals any crime that the rich man or one of his ancestors may have committed. Moreover, if one wishes to harass some enemy, then at a little expense he will be able to harm the just and the unjust alike, for by means of spells and enchantments they can persuade the gods to serve them. They bring the poets as witnesses to all of this, some harping on the easiness of vice, that, quote, vice is easy to choose in abundance, the path is smooth and it dwells very near, but sweat is placed by the gods on the way to virtue. And a path which is long, rough, and steep, others quote Homer as a witness that the gods can be influenced by men, for he too said, the gods themselves can be swayed by prayer. For suppliant men can turn them from their purpose by sacrifices and gentle prayers, by libations and burnt offerings, whenever anyone has transgressed or sinned. They offer in proof of a mass of writings by Musaeus and Orpheus, offspring, as they say, of Selene and the Muses. In accordance with these, they perform their rituals and persuade not only individuals, but whole cities that both for the living and for the dead, they are absolutions and purifications for sin by means of sacrifice and the pleasurable, playful rituals. These they call initiations, which free from punishment yonder, where a dreadful fate awaits the uninitiated. I'll just stop for a second and just say, so this is similar to, say maybe like TV preachers who might today, you know, promise that you can be forgiven for all your sins, but you do have to like send them some money for their whatever. Okay. Or, you know, there's something that you need to do for them in exchange for it's kind of like the old indulgences, you know, of the medieval Catholic Church, right? You do something, then you get all your sins forgiven. So you might as well just go ahead and be unjust because it's so easy. All right, anyway, Adeimantus continues. When all such sayings about the attitudes of men and gods towards virtue and vice are so often repeated, what effect, my dear Socrates, do we think they have upon the minds of our youth? One who is naturally talented and able, like a bee flitting from flower to flower, flower gathering honey, to flit over these sayings and to gather from them an impression of what kind of man he should be and of how best to travel along the road of life, would surely repeat to himself the words, the sayings of Pindar. Should I by justice or by crooked deceit scale this high wall and thus live my life fenced off from other men? The advantages said to be mine, if I am just, are of no use. I am told, unless I also appear to be just, while the troubles and penalties are obvious. The unjust man, on the other hand, who has secured for himself a reputation for justice, lives, they tell me, the life of a god. Therefore, since appearance, as the wise man tells me, forcibly overwhelms truth and controls of happiness, this is altogether the way I should live. I should build around me a facade that gives the illusion of justice to those who approach me and keep behind this the greedy and crafty fox of the wise Archilochus. Okay, so I'm going to read another selection pretty soon, which is Socrates' response to this, which I think is super interesting. But I just want to kind of emphasize Adeimantus's overall point. Like the message here is that, hey, Socrates, Even the gods don't really take justice seriously, and they actually kind of seem to reward the crafty rich person who can, who can afford to do a lot of sacrifices and pay the priests. Okay, so very cynical, and so the reason why this is important is that Socrates is going to tackle this. And it's going to be what instigates his proposal for a reevaluation of what to teach people about the gods. Socrates has a different notion of what the gods really are all about. And as we'll see later on in like in week four of the seminar, I'll talk about some of the proofs of God's existence in Plato, and he had arguments for a first mover type of God. So, what we see here is we see established some critique of the Greek pantheon. Okay, so here's his response in book two. I don't have time here to go into all the reasons why this comes up, but suffice it to say that he's starting to discuss what real leaders, guardians and leaders would have to be taught in order to make them just and, worthy of actually ruling. So this is Socrates, and you can think of this as a response to what Adeimantus just said. He says, "Shall we then carelessly allow the children to hear any kind of stories composed by anybody and to take into their souls beliefs which are for the most part contrary to those we think they should hold in maturity? We shall certainly not allow that. Then we must first of all, it seems, control the storytellers. Whatever noble story they compose, we shall select, but a bad one we must reject. Then we shall persuade nurses and mothers to tell their children those we have selected, and by those stories to fashion their minds far more than they can shape their bodies by handling them. The majority of the stories they now tell must be thrown out." And he asks, "Which do you mean?" Socrates says, "We shall be able to examine the lesser by observing the larger, for they must all have the same mold and the same effect, whether they be large or small." And Socrates says, "We shall be able to examine the lesser by observing the larger, for they must all have much the same mold and the same effect, whether they be large or small. Do you not think so?" "I do," he said, "but I do not know which you call large." Socrates says, "Those, I said, by Hesiod and Homer and the other poets, for they put together fictitious stories and told them to men, and they still do." "Which stories do you mean?" said he, "and why do you object to them?" Which is interesting because didn't Adeimantus just say a little bit earlier these types of stories lead him to be cynical? "Because of what one should object to first and most, especially if the fictitious is not well told. As for instance," Socrates says, "whenever any story gives a bad image of the nature of the gods and heroes, like a painter drawing a bad picture, unlike the model he is wanting to portray." And then we see Socrates use the L word. Okay, he says, "First, I said, the greatest lie about the most important matters was that of the man who told bad fiction when he said that Uranus did what Hesiod tells us he did, and how Cronos punished him for it. Then again, even if the deeds of Cronos and what he suffered from his son were true, I do not think that this should be told to foolish and young people. It should be passed over in silence. If there were some necessity to tell it, only a very few people should hear it. And in secret, after sacrificing not a pig, but some great and scarce victim, so as few people as possible should hear it." And Adeimantus says, "Yes, these stories are hard to deal with." And then Socrates said, "And they should not be told, Adeimantus," I said, "in our city. Nor should a young man hear it said that in committing the worst crimes he is not doing anything out of the way. Or that if he inflicts every kind of punishment upon an erring father, he is only doing the same as the first and greatest of the gods." "No, by Zeus," Adeimantus said, "I myself do not think these things are fit to be told." "Nor indeed," Socrates says, any tales of gods warring and plotting and fighting against each other. These things are not true. If those who are to guard our city are to think it shameful to be easily driven to hate each other, certainly stories of battles of giants must not be told nor embroidered, nor all the various stories of gods hating their kindred or friends. If we are to persuade our people that no citizen has ever hated another and that this is impious, then it is the kind of tale we should tell right away to small children and to old men and women also, and to the middle-aged, and we must compel our poets to follow those guidelines. We shall not admit into our city stories about Hera being chained by her son or Hephaestus being hurled from heaven by his father when he intended to help his mother who was being beaten, nor the battle of the gods in Homer, whether these stories are told allegorically or without allegory. The young cannot distinguish what is allegorical from what is not. And the beliefs they acquire at that age are hard to expunge and usually remain unchanged. That may be the reason why it is most important that the first stories they hear should be well told and dispose them to virtue. Okay, well, there's more. But these two selections, I hope, give you an idea of what Socrates' problem is with Greek polytheism. At the very least, it appears that Socrates thought that Greek polytheism did not teach people good moral lessons about how to live their lives. And there seems to be a notion lurking there that the main purpose of religion, according to Socrates, ought to be to try to shape people's lives into being self-controlled and just. Even further underneath, I think he's questioning whether such types of gods exist. Can you call a being a god if it acts worse than most human beings do? So all of this is kind of in the mix. And I hope that you enjoyed this reading and these observations, and that they gave you food for thought. I'll see you next time when we will be talking about, among other things, the allegory of the cave in Plato's Republic.